Thank you. The second case on our docket this afternoon is 25-40583, Travelers Property Casualty Company of America versus Erickson Incorporated. And I don't want to mispronounce your name.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's Michael Chen, Your Honor, for Erickson and the other appellants. May it please the court. The underlying lawsuits here fall within the Texas insurance law definition of accident because they contain allegations of chains of events that Erickson, quote, did not know and, quote, did not care what happened. That should make this a straightforward case under the Texas rule that any potentially covered allegation is enough to trigger the duty to defend. Now, where the insurers have tried to complicate this case and where the district court went astray is that these complaints do contain other allegations that the insurers say favor them. But Texas law addresses that situation too. And when there are mixed allegations, some covered and some not covered, the duty to defend applies. There is no weighing test, there's no gravamen test, there's no sparseness test. Instead, the rule is that non-covered allegations cannot negate covered ones. The presence of any covered allegation is enough. These rules are important. Customers of insurance, of this insurance, buy this insurance against the backdrop of Texas's broad duty to defend that resolves all doubts in favor of coverage, that construes the underlying allegations liberally in favor of the insured, and that provides a defense even for unmeritorious claims. This court should preserve those important Texas settled rules and reverse the accident decision below. On the exclusions, the district court did not reach those, and this court does not need to either, but if it does, it should hold that the insurers have not met their burden of showing that all the allegations here fall within the exclusions. On the accident issue, which is where I intend to spend most of my time, I want to point out that the case in our favor, I think, is actually quite straightforward. You just have to look for the presence of any covered allegation. We've pointed to a number of them. I think the starkest ones are maybe the ones in paragraph 295D of the Schmitz complaint. That's where they allege that Erickson did not know and did not care where its money was going, and the MTN allegations. And those allegations all go to what the parties here agree is the analysis sufficient to resolve the first prong of the accident inquiry, which is, did Erickson intentionally pay FTOs? And those are allegations that Erickson did not intentionally pay FTOs. So let me take a moment to emphasize the MTN allegations.
Before you do that, one way to do it, since the complaints are so enormous, is to just simply search for words like indifferent or reckless. Is it roughly correct that in the span of these two complaints, reckless, for example, comes up only a half dozen times?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
And then a couple of those are quoting from an SEC lawsuit. So we put those aside?
I'm not sure you put them aside. I think okay. You look to what the plaintiffs are trying to establish with those allegations. But even if you set them aside, I think we still have other allegations that get us to the right. Duty to defend.
And you started by saying the best one is paragraph what?
I pointed to 295D of the Schmitz complaint.
Okay.
That's in the record at 5903. Uh-huh. Those are the allegations that Erickson acted with indifference to where its money was going.
How many times indifference comes up twice, correct?
It's in that allegation and 391C.
Mm-hmm. 391?
Correct, Your Honor. Those are allegations that Erickson did not know and did not care where its money was going. That is directly, so that shows that Erickson did not intentionally pay FTOs.
I have just a legal question and a factual question, but I'm looking around for the documents that help me with them. Legally, if this may be just completely off base, but if the entire suit for which you want them to defend you requires a showing of intentionality, why are we wondering at all what's in these complaints? Because if you're right, if ultimately they can't show intentionality, the district court reserved on the issue of whether they have to indemnify you. Do you see my point? In other words, if the entire lawsuit you're saying they owe you requires intentionality, isn't that sort of the end of the story? They don't owe you any duty to defend.
It's not, Your Honor, because this is a duty to defend case, yeah. Not a duty to indemnify case.
I know
case.
That.
And the reason that's important is because the purpose of this insurance is to protect us against the litigation itself.
The complaints, to meet an ATA claim, the complaints have to allege intentionality. That's got to be the gravamen of the whole thing. Is your is your point, and this is a fair point, is your point that they just sort of mistakenly put in recklessness in the allegations, and those sparse, whatever the district court called them, those alone, even if there were mistaken additions, that creates the duty?
I'm not sure I would agree with every bit of how Your Honor phrased it, but yes. And I think the important point is that the duty to defend under Texas law does not turn on the legal theory alleged. I think the theory that the insurers are pushing, that I understand Your Honor to be asking about, is exactly the opposite of that. Under the insurer's theory, you look and you see this is legally an ATA claim, and that's dispositive. You don't look to the factual allegations. That is the flip of what Texas law requires. I think the intuition...
The best case in Texas law, would you say a pretty darn good one, is Lamar Holmes?
Sure, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, because the court went out of its way to say an intentional tort is not an accident, is not an occurrence, regardless of whether the effect was unintended. So it doesn't really matter whether, of course, I mean, I shouldn't say of course, I guess the lawsuit will prove it true, but it's highly doubtful. I don't see them contending that Erickson intended U.S. Servicing to get killed, but they did intend to make the payments, and the people who received the payments did intend to kill. So is the logic here that it's too attenuated between the two intended acts?
Well, let me address Lamar Holmes, and then let me address this suit.
Yeah.
Lamar Holmes stated that rule, but I think the correct understanding of what Lamar Holmes was saying is that factual allegations of intentional tort show that there's no accident. Lamar Holmes did not say, let me look at the legal form of this claim and then ignore the factual allegations. So that's Lamar Holmes. I think you can look to Nokia for support for what I just said about what the intentional tort rule is. Now, as to these claims, on the merits, yes, we think the mental state required for the ATA is very high. We think some of the allegations here are low. On the merits, we think that means we should win. But the duty to defend does not turn on the merits. Texas law is clear that even unmeritorious claims get a defense. So I think the intuition maybe behind your questions, or at least behind the insurer's argument, is that if the allegations here fall short of what's required under the ATA, then those claims should lose on the merits, and then therefore they should not get a defense. That last bit is wrong under Texas law. The whole point of this insurance is so that we can protect ourselves when we get sued, even if we get sued baselessly. Texas law is clear about that. You can look to, for example, the Don's Building Supply.
The district court, it's a short opinion, relied heavily on Bluebonnet. And your response to Bluebonnet, I mean, there we have ice cream, the executives, people end up getting listeria. And it's not accidental. It's not a covered occurrence because they were on sufficient notice. So would you accept that description of the case?
I think so. But
so you're just saying here the allegations in the complaint don't allege that your client was on notice?
I think there are allegations here that Erickson did not know and did not care. And again, I think the parties agree that you can answer the accident inquiry by asking, did Erickson intentionally pay FTOs? And I think we have these allegations they didn't. Let me spin out the
but
NTN allegations.
Why, if the gravamen of the complaint is they didn't know, they didn't care, if that were true, why would there be heavy allegations that they're falsifying documents? They're concealing documents of the payments. That makes it sound highly intentional.
I'm not disputing what the gravamen of the complaint is, Your Honor, because
you're
I don't think
any reference, even one reference to recklessness, they owe you. That's the position.
It's more or less the position. I think what I want to be precise about is we're not saying, you know, if you control F for recklessness in a complaint, you find it, then there's coverage. We are acknowledging that what the insurance policy covers is suits seeking damages for injuries caused by accident. So you have to have a whole factual theory for how the injury arose from unintentional conduct, but we think we have that here. Again, the allegations that Erickson did not know and did not care where its money was going is an allegation that Erickson did not intentionally pay FTOs. The MTN allegations are the same thing, and I think it's an even more sort of specific example of what we're talking about. MTN is an Afghan telecommunications company. The allegation is that the Taliban used MTN cell towers to aid downstream terrorist attacks. What was Erickson's alleged role? Erickson was an upstream supplier to MTN, and there were allegations that Erickson did not know for many years any link between MTN and terrorism. So we spelled that out at reply brief 5. And so before 2010, there are allegations that Erickson's supplying MTN led to downstream injuries, but there aren't allegations of knowledge. So this is a clear illustration where Erickson is allegedly supplying resources to downstream terrorist organizations, but Erickson does not know of that link, and so Erickson did not send those resources intentionally. I want to address the sparseness point, Your Honor, because that's another area.
What did the district court say about your argument to us now? Remind me. He said, oh, it's just labels, it's not allegations, and you would say that's false and that's evident on the complaint. But he made multiple, two or three separate arguments as to this reckless, you can find it.
Yes, I think I read the district court as maybe advancing two grounds. One is sparseness, but there's no sparseness test under Texas law. Instead, the rule is any covered allegation is enough. And to put it another way, non-covered allegations cannot negate covered ones. So there's no sparseness test, there's no weighing test. You're just, the task is to look for the presence of any covered allegation. The district court's other rationale is the district court set aside the allegations that favor us, saying that these are just labels, not factual allegations. That I really don't understand, because the allegations we're pointing to are about what Erickson did not know, about what Erickson's intent was, and all of the MTN allegations. So if allegations that Erickson acted knowingly were inbounds and sufficiently factual, then allegations that Erickson did not know should equally be inbounds and equally factual. The MTN allegations are an entire Roman numeral section of the factual allegations section of the complaints. And so I don't see how you can set that aside as somehow just being a label and not factual. So I think an opinion in our favor is quite straightforward. You pick any covered allegation. I would pick maybe MTN. I would maybe pick 295D. I would say those are allegations that Erickson did not intentionally pay FTOs. The parties here agree that you can resolve the first prong in this appeal on that basis, and that's it. Any covered allegation is enough. I think to resolve it in the insurer's favor, I don't think it's possible to write an opinion without breaking something in Texas law. If you say the allegations are too sparse, you've created a new sparseness rule that's totally foreign to Texas law. If you say these are mere labels and not real factual allegations, you've introduced hopeless confusion into what is an inbounds allegation. Again, if Erickson acted knowingly as inbounds, how can Erickson did not know be out of bounds? And if you say that it's just because it's the ATA, if it's an ATA claim, then it cannot be covered, that's also a new rule. It would be a first of its kind holding that the legal label alone is enough. You don't look to the factual allegations. And you would also and you would also create a perverse situation where that's an exception to the rule that it's factual allegations, not legal theories. And it is a one-way rule that only goes against the insured. And that's contrary to Texas law, which is favoring coverage and favoring the duty to defend. I think if you adopt that last theory, the one that the ATA label is enough, I think you also create another problem, which is you inject insurance coverage courts trying to decide the duty to defend, and you have them injecting themselves into the merits that are currently playing out. So what the ATA requires in terms of mental state and whether these allegations are factually and legally sufficient, that's exactly what the parties in the underlying cases are currently litigating in DDC right now. And under the insurer's theory, this court would have to interject itself, decide some of those questions in this collateral litigation with a different group of parties, and potentially reach inconsistent results with what the DC courts are going to decide. And that nightmare scenario is not what Texas calls for. Texas decides the duty to defend irrespective of the merits. And again, the intuition, I think, behind their rule is that, or their theory is that these allegations should fail on the merits. But that does not defeat the duty to defend, because the duty applies
to meritorious claims. So just means we've got to do our job and go through these complaints microscopically. When I started to do it, I do encounter the few times it refers to reckless. It's, for example, in a parenthesis. Defendants knowingly parens or recklessly paid protection money to Al-Qaeda. So it's a very subordinate reference to reckless. And then and in another occasion, they knew or they recklessly disregarded the corruption program, but no matter what, it was therefore foreseeable that. So the same sentence that uses recklessness then makes the intentionality point that highly probable, like the Chiquita Brands case.
So I think the complaint in those instances is using knowingly and recklessly as alternative theories about Erickson's mental state. And so Erickson was either acting knowingly or was acting not knowingly but recklessly. And so the plaintiffs are trying to advance a factual theory that Erickson acted less than knowingly. And I think it's not surprising that plaintiffs would do this. Intent is hard to prove. And so plaintiffs might make allegations of intent, but they might advance alternative factual theories of something less than intent and try to pin liability on that too. So it's not surprising that plaintiffs would do this, and Texas law provides coverage in those scenarios. As long as any allegation, any theory of liability factually
falls. What was your answer, just quickly, I know time's up, but you have rebuttal time. If they are making an overarching claim that throughout your client's falsifying records, doesn't that sort of create an overarching intentionality?
I don't think
occasionally they were reckless in terms of this will end up in Al-Qaeda after it goes through three different levels of subcontractors. The overarching claim is Erickson knows this money is to pay off terrorists, and they know it because they're falsifying records about it.
Your Honor, there's no overarching test.
There's no
overarching. Under the duty to defend, any covered allegation is enough. And so in order to find no duty to defend, you'd have to somehow ignore the MTN allegations, ignore 295D,
Your well prepared, and so you may have this case. Is there a case in Texas law that sort of the tail completely wags the dog, where there's just one reference to fortuity, and yet that still compels duty to defend? Does one come to mind? This theory that it could just be one stray reference and the insurance company's on the line.
Well, I don't have a case that talks about stray or not, because again, that's just not part of the legal inquiry under the duty to defend. But you can look at Nokia. Look at Harkin.
Nokia's as good a one as any.
I would point to Nokia, because there, the court said there are allegations of intentional conduct, and then there are allegations of unintentional conduct, and the allegations of intentional conduct cannot negate the allegations of unintentional conduct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks.
May it please the court. My name is Courtney Irvin. I represent Travelers, and I'll be speaking first on behalf of the insurers on whether the complaints allege an occurrence. So let's frame this first on how the duty to defend is determined. The first question, and it's the insured's burden, is to prove there is a potentially covered cause of action. And that's why the fact that these complaints solely seek to hold the insured's liable under the Anti-Terrorism Act is dispositive here. Because Judge Higginson, you're correct. It requires intentional conduct to be liable under the ATA. Put differently, you cannot be liable under the ATA for an accident. This also makes sense under the eight corners rule, because the policy, which is four of those corners, limits the insurance coverage to those sums that the insured is legally obligated to pay as damages. So if the sole basis for recovering damages is something that's not an accident, then you can't have any coverage at all. And I'd like to swing just a little bit to this idea of if it's an unmeritorious case, then you automatically have a duty to defend. That's not true if you don't initially trigger the policy. So where you don't have coverage at all because there's not a potentially covered cause of action, or you don't have coverage because of the second part of the test, which would be that the factual allegations going to the source of damages don't plead a potentially covered claim, then there's just no duty at all. You haven't triggered the policy.
Let's imagine the complaint were just this MTM, which looks like the most attenuated. And so Erickson's out there building the cell towers, whatever, they're paying excessively, and ultimately the excessive payments do end up in the pocket of sort of roving bands or terrorists. It may be a very weak ATA claim because they just didn't have any reason to foresee. Wouldn't you have a duty to defend them?
So I have two answers to your question. First, it's the factual allegations in these complaints under that hypothetical that govern.
Right.
And the factual allegations are actually that, and remember, they're taken without regard for truth or falsity. You can think that they aren't true at all, but we take them as true at this duty to defend analysis, is that the defendants knew its facilitation of MTN's tower shutdowns was inextricably connected to Al-Qaeda and Taliban violence, and defendants aided their acts of terrorism, meaning the FTOs, targeting Americans. That's paragraph 657. And even in the insured's own briefing, they acknowledge that the allegation that the plaintiffs make is that Erickson's a but-for causation in MTN being able to shut down the terror, the towers, and therefore aiding and abetting acts of terrorism. Okay.
You both are superbly prepared. Are you prepared to respond by paragraph then? Because he did describe the two paragraphs he said. So one was 295D and the other one is 391C.
Yes.
Do you happen to know those directly?
Yes. So this is where, and I think Your Honor already picked up on a big component of this. So the overarching, and if I can kind of back up just for a minute.
You can if you eventually get back to those.
I will get back to it. And if I don't, please remind me because it means I forgot. So these complaints, and I think this is critical here, are not pleading alternative factual bases to support liability under the ATA. Instead, there's a foundational allegation in these complaints, which is repeatedly and consistently pled throughout these complaints, which is that the insureds allegedly are purposely funding foreign terrorist organizations as part of an agreement with those FTOs to route attacks away from Erickson's business interests and towards others. That's paragraph 536. Which also expressly pleads these payments are no accident. Then the complaints go through a multitude of examples that are all intended to support that overarching allegation, and it's that overarching allegation that is what's pleading the plaintiff's claims under the ATA. And so, for example, if we extract out the MTN allegation, you fundamentally change these complaints. Because these complaints are not pleading, just because Erickson has an office in D.C., they're liable under the ATA. They aren't even pleading just because of the MTN circumstance that they're liable under the ATA. Instead, they're saying that for a period of 15 years, these insureds were illegally funding terrorists in violation of U.S. terrorism laws, and that these are all the examples that support that. And now I'm going to get back to your question, because there's two ways that these payments are being made. Direct payments, which they don't contest, would not be covered, and then indirect payments, and they're sort of conflating indirect with involuntary. But the allegations are that it's all purposeful. And so Erickson has leaked documents that the plaintiffs rely on, and that's where these words show up, that a documented track record of expressed indifference and that Erickson did not know and did not care where its money was going. That's that paragraph 295. Mm-hmm. And then it actually repeats those allegations again at paragraph 391 because it does it once for Iraq and once for Afghanistan. But that's pled as part of Erickson can't trace its money, but that's by design. That's because Erickson's using slush funds, sham contracts, intermediaries, and what the complaints say are intentionally deficient internal controls that were a feature, not a bug, and were purpose-built to facilitate and conceal its protection payments to terrorists. That's paragraph 928. And so within that context, Erickson's own documents say, we can't affirmatively trace that our money made it to a foreign terrorist organization, but that's different from not intending to pay them, because the allegation is actually that it's on purpose that they can't trace the money. And in fact, what the allegation is that defendants chose to funnel their illicit payments through intermediaries, slush funds, and deliberately deficient internal controls heightens their culpability. The protection payments may have often been physically delivered by an intermediary, but defendants knew they were occurring and purposefully orchestrated them. That's paragraph 869. And I would also point this court to paragraphs 277 through 280, which goes through a list of the myriad of ways that these insureds are alleged to have been intentionally paying foreign terrorist organizations, but concealing those payments, which again, this is part of this overarching allegation that in doing a decades-long, more than a decades-long, corruption scheme, that they're making these payments in a way that avoids detection. And I would also point the court, so going back to this
Lamar Holmes, you probably know it well.
Yes.
There's sort of compound sentences there. So it's pretty clear, it seems, a deliberate act is an accident if the effect is not the intended or expected result. It is an act. Even though it was deliberate, it's still an accident if it wasn't intended. And then they sort of try to, Texas says, we're asking about the natural and expected result of something. Would it be highly probable? And so I'll turn that into a question. The drunk driving case law that both of you put in the briefs, the Frederick King case is probably the one you have to answer, right? Because the court there says you sure didn't intend eventually to kill someone, but you did intend to get drunk. That's still an accident that's covered, right?
That was an accident under Frederick King. And so I would distinguish Frederick King in two ways. One, it was whether automobile accidents are covered under automobile policies. And the court there was very concerned in holding that any automobile accident wouldn't be an accident under an auto policy. We don't have that here. And also, there was an issue of the court held that going to a bar and getting drunk doesn't make it highly probable that you will have an automobile accident, and that the insurer didn't go to the bar hoping to have an automobile accident. And I would distinguish that from what we have here. Here we have allegations of intentionally funding designated foreign terrorist organizations as part of an agreement that those foreign terrorist organizations would route their attacks away from the insured and towards others like these plaintiffs. That's awfully close, if not equal to, hoping that this will be the outcome.
Do you agree that the case relied on by the district court, Bluebonnet, is stronger than the allegations here? There was just CDC, home officials, the management themselves, lab tests, everybody was telling them your ice cream's got listeria.
So I think they're either the same, or I would maybe even argue they're stronger here.
Yours are stronger.
And here is
so
one.
They absolutely knew it was going to kill Americans, the money they were given.
There's two parts to the test when we're talking about this one, an intentional act and then the natural and foreseeable consequence of it. So if you go to the intentionality of the act, I think the allegations here are more direct. The district court got it right. There are no allegations of involuntary conduct.
Okay.
Bluebell is ignoring positive listeria test results, and then it's also failing to have effective corporate controls. And remember here, it's deliberately deficient corporate controls. And then the second part of the test, is it the natural and foreseeable result? I think it's important to recognize Bluebell is actually a shareholder derivative lawsuit. The harm that's being alleged there is financial harm, that the directors and officers basically brought Bluebell down. It's not the bodily injury. And the reason that I bring that up, and this court's own opinion goes through sort of what I would argue is an attenuated chain. So the intentional act is ignoring the listeria positive test results. And then this court says that that reasonably foreseeably caused the outbreak, which then resulted in a product recall, which then resulted in the company shutting down, and then resulted in the millions of dollars of damages. And that is what was being sought by the shareholders. Here, you have funding terrorists results in terrorist attacks that foreseeably and expectedly results in injuries, including against these plaintiffs.
So you're not trying to impute the terrorist's intent to the insured?
There's sort of a two-part answer to that. Okay. Not in terms of the intentional act. The intentional act is expressly and repeatedly alleged that they intentionally paid foreign terrorist organizations. However, they did that knowing that these terrorists engage in terrorist attacks, and that's what makes it highly probable that when you're funding terrorists, you fund those terrorist operations. And I would like to, if I can, and Judge Higginson, you're right. I mean, these are overwhelmingly long complaints. And so, yes, the duty to defend analysis is that you have to wade through it. But I would point out the allegations under the causes of action. because I think that's a good place to start and maybe even end, because those are the factual allegations that are supporting the basis for liability. And those are that each defendant was both knowingly paying the terrorists, but also doing so in support of their terrorist activities. And so that's not an accident under Texas law. And just let me give you the citation. It starts at paragraph 3892 in Schmitz and paragraph 2635 in Wirtz. Thank you.
May it please the court, Manuel Munguia, also speaking on behalf of the insurers. I want to address the exclusions, but before I do, I wanted to, Your Honor, address one of the questions you had about the best case that addresses a stray reference that could be covered, but
they
doesn't
cited
go
Nokia.
To... So what I would argue is it's a case that this court, I believe, is very familiar with, which is Liberty Mutual versus Copart. Because in that, Liberty Mutual versus Copart, in that 75 F4th 522. It's a 2023 case from the Fifth Circuit that I believe Your Honor authored.
I remember it perfectly. Okay, go ahead.
It was a case dealing with a pollution exclusion. And Copart, who is the defendant, was arguing, well, the pollution exclusion can't apply because there's references to 30 non-pollutants in the complaint. Water, soil, sediment. And what this court said is there may be these stray references to water or to soil or to sediment, but the narrative thrust of the complaint is that rainfall carries pollutant-laden stormwater from Copart's properties to the plaintiff's properties and causes the harm. And what the court pointed out correctly is there's no allegations that the water and the non-pollutants were what was causing harm. Those were stray facts, but they were not the liability cause triggering facts. The liability triggering facts, the facts that mattered when you say, well, it's not just the legal theories, but it's also, you got to look at the facts. It's the facts supporting the liability.
Well, I appreciate you mentioning it. I wrote it, and I will look at it, but did you give them a fair notice on this? Is this in the brief?
This is cited in our brief.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And that's a duty to defend case?
And it's a duty to defend case. The court found no duty to defend. And it's the same thing. It applies here. I would say the court actually went further, which I think you were just with my colleague doing, is they said you have to read the complaint as a whole. You can't just take stray references out of context, and you have to read them collectively. And here, there is no accidental violation of the ATA.
There cannot be.
You can't negligently violate the ATA. So the gravamen of the complaint has to be that there's intentional conduct, right? And it can't. So there may be stray references to
just because time's running out. Respond to the case they said was their strongest, Nokia.
The Nokia case. I don't have that in front of me, and okay. I don't have it. But I would argue is that the Copart case addresses this exactly. And I would give the court another example about the importance of the liability triggering events. Let's say that it was a murder case and there was an intentional conduct exclusion that we were looking at. And let's say that the indictment alleged that the defendant recklessly drove to the victim's house or even negligently drove to the victim's house, but then they pulled out a gun and intentionally and with intent shot the victim. Well, the facts and the allegations that you would have to consider when considering whether or not there's coverage for that intentional act is not the negligent driving to the victim's house, not the reckless driving to the victim's house, but the intentional conduct in killing the victim. That's the murder. That's the liability. That's the cause of action. And then that's also the facts that support the cause of action. Here, the facts that support the cause of action, because the cause of action has two prongs. You either act an act of intentional terrorism, or two, you aid and abet by knowingly providing substantial assistance to or conspiring with a person who commits intentional terrorism. So the facts to support that cause of action must be intentional, must be knowing.
We know we're looking at the allegations. So I could imagine any U.S. oil company getting sued under ATA just because they're paying so much money and some of it eventually dribbles into the hands of Al-Qaeda. Those cases, even if you had to prove intentionality, if they are going to fail because the allegations suggest deliberate indifference or whatever, you'd have to pay for that, those cases, correct?
Well, if what the allegations are
They just weren't attentive enough. They didn't have checks and balances, and the money got
there. If it was just a negligent allegation, if there was a negligence cause of action, then we would say yes. But that's not the case here.
Let's just be very precise about it. Let's suppose the only allegations in the complaint were that an oil company deliberately and differently paid money to a terrorist, and that's a violation of the ATA. Well, you get summary judgment on that, but it's going to cost you money to hire a lawyer and go in and get the summary judgment. Is that covered or not?
That would not be covered, Your Honor. If the allegations are of purely intentional conduct. Now, if ultimately they prove, as I think the district court said, that there's...
Now, I'm talking about not the exclusion piece, but just the duty to defend absent the exclusion.
Correct. The duty to defend is based upon the eight corners, and that's...
But I thought there were Texas cases, and I think I may have written one that said, you know, on its face, the complaint is deficient. You would be entitled to summary judgment. As soon as you get to court, you'll get summary judgment. But the insurance company has a duty to defend that because it comes within the duty to defend. Now, there may be exclusion for we don't have to defend.
But I think the duty to defend, in the first instance, it's their duty to show that there's a covered claim that would have to be defended. And what our position would be, if the only allegations are of intentional conduct, then you never
get there. But there are no allegations of intentional conduct. My point is that there are no allegations of intentional conduct. The only allegation is that the oil company deliberately, with indifference, not intentionally, we don't want to know, we don't care, here's some money. If that's the only allegation, and that says that's a violation of the ATA, why wouldn't you have the obligation to defend there? Because there was no allegation of intentional misconduct.
So again, if we're in a hypothetical space, yes, and there's no allegations of intentional conduct, then I believe we would. If what they alleged is purely something that doesn't meet the standard for the ATA, of intentionality, we would evaluate that on the merits, and in that case, then there would be an obligation to pay. But that's not this case. Because in this case, again, the gravamen of the complaint is intentionality, because the plaintiffs want to meet the standard necessary to survive a motion to dismiss, presumably.
The allegations of destroyed and falsified documents covered all, or they were just specific to some portions.
I think that goes throughout. Again, I think it carries on throughout the complaint. I see my time's up. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple of points. First, on Copart. Copart, I don't think, stands for the analysis that the insurers are trying to draw from it. They're trying to draw sort of a narrative thrust test where you sort of like squint and look at the complaint for the gravamen of it. That's not what Copart was doing. Respectfully, Copart was looking at one specific phrase in one paragraph and trying to understand what the complaint meant. And for that, it looked to the rest of the complaint to understand what that phrase meant. The phrase was water, sediment, and other matter. And the question was, does that water, sediment, and other matter include pollutants? The court looked to the other allegations to understand that the complaint must have meant other pollutants. That's completely different from the issue here. There's no uncertainty over whether the complaints really meant Erickson did not know or did not care. Those words can only be interpreted one way. What the insurers are trying to do here is use other allegations to defeat or negate those covered allegations, and that's what Texas law says you cannot do. Next, on the specific allegations, MTN, they pointed to paragraph 657 about knowledge. That paragraph says that the knowledge started in 2010. But there are other paragraphs. You look at paragraph 667, 668. Plaintiffs are trying to get liability for before 2010. And so there are years before 2010 where the plaintiffs are trying to get liability on these MTM allegations, and there's no knowledge. If there's any doubt about that, Texas says you have to liberally construe the allegations in favor of the insured. And so I don't think we need that. But if we did, that would get us home. Next, on Erickson, Inc. These are the allegations that Erickson, Inc., was a but-for cause just because it maintained a presence in Washington, D.C. The insurers, I think, said that the plaintiffs aren't really trying to establish liability based on that. I think they clearly are. Look to paragraphs 495, 496 of the complaint. This is where, this is a subsection of the complaint where there's like five or six ways where the complaint says that Ericsson Inc. participated. This is one of the ways. One of the ways, one of the theories is they had an office in Washington, D.C. They had this Washington, D.C. presence. That was a but-for cause of the injuries. That's clearly accidental. You can use that as the any potentially covered allegation to rule in our favor. And then finally on 295D and 391C, I think their response was to point to paragraph 928, so like several hundred paragraphs later, and they want to use that paragraph to negate or defeat the ones that we're pointing to. That's exactly what Texas law says you cannot do. You cannot use non-covered allegations to defeat covered ones. The plaintiffs...
But allegations are different than manner and means. So if one way that it facilitated the whole corrupt payment program was they had an office, that isn't saying that's a push. That is a point of liability on its own. We've just described that one of the building blocks for the intentional tort was that. Isn't that, when you focus in on, oh, they had an office, that surely doesn't convey intentionality.
So I think maybe an important point to clarify here is there's multiple Ericsson entities, and that allegation about the Washington, D.C. office is about Ericsson Inc., which is the U.S. entity. Yep. And many different times in the complaints, the plaintiffs are trying to find some theory to pin liability on the U.S. entity, even though most of the supposed protection payments are coming from the other entities. And so this is one of their theories. That's, I think they've numbered them in paragraph around paragraph 495, but I think they number this number five. This is one of their theories for how they can hold Ericsson Inc. liable. And again, if you have some uncertainties about how to read the complaint, you have to liberally construe the allegations in our favor. And I think you can fairly read this complaint to say that one way the plaintiffs are trying to pin liability on Ericsson as a but-for cause of these attacks is the presence in Washington, D.C. Last, I want to emphasize that we think the exact right way to look at this is how Judge Richman was viewing it in the questions that she asked, which is, if you had a complaint under the ATA, the only allegation, say, was Ericsson did not know and did not care where its money was going, or the only allegation was the pre-2010 MTN allegations or the Washington, D.C. allegations, that is clearly within the duty to defend. Texas law says you look to the factual allegations, the policy's text covers suits seeking damages for injuries caused by accident. Those factual allegations would clearly fall within that scope. The only question is, if you add in other allegations, allegations of knowing conduct, intentional conduct, does that change the outcome? Texas law says no, because non-covered allegations cannot negate covered ones. Any potentially covered allegation is enough. That is the rule in Texas. It has always been the rule in Texas, and this court should preserve that rule by reversing and not disturb it by affirming. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments for this afternoon. The court stands at adjournment until 9 o'clock in the morning. Thank you.
Thank you.